Okay, it's your turn now. We'll take phone calls with our special guest this hour, Richard Dolan. So get ready. That's all next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Let's go now to Richard C. Hoagland with an update on the space shuttle Atlantis. What do we know, Richard?
Okay, George, it's a scrub.
Oh, no.
Yep, they've been having this problem they've been looking at with fuel cell number one when they turned her on tonight as part of the prep to energize the systems in the orbiter prior to putting the fuel in the big tank, the big orange tank. They found a weird voltage undervolt on apparently fuel cell number one. They've been troubleshooting. They've been trying to decide, do we tank simultaneously with the troubleshooting? And you don't want to do that because when you put 500,000 gallons of this super cold hydrogen and oxygen in these two tanks, the whole tank shrinks and is covered with foam, remember?
Yes.
And what happens when you shrink metal inside foam that doesn't shrink at the same rate?
You have a problem.
The foam may separate from the tank, and then it will fall off and kill the orbiter. So they don't want to do the tanking if they're not going to launch tomorrow, and they're not going to launch tomorrow now. They're holding out the hope they might get off on Thursday. Frankly, between you and me and a few of our most intimate friends listening, I don't think it's going to happen.
No. Do they have to move the entire shuttle?
If there's a serious problem with fuel cell number one, meaning the lightning that struck last Friday did something really nasty, You couldn't trust that the readings you're getting under the conditions of sitting on the pad were reliable. And you really need to be in orbit with three good fuel cells. You don't want, one that's flaky on you.
Right.
Because that would end your mission, and then you couldn't do what you had to do anyway. And then you got a payload in the payload bay. It's just a huge nightmare. So they're not going to go till they absolutely are, absolutely positively, as FedEx used to say, certain they've got a good one, and that may mean they have to roll her back to the vehicle assembly building. That means we miss the next two-day window. We miss September. The next opportunity would be 2 days in late October, and then not until December 14th, where I think we have one day. No, I'm sorry, the 23rd, the day before Christmas Eve. And then not till February 9th of next year, George.
This is a bad dream, Richard.
Well, it's a bad spacecraft. The shuttle is over and done. We should retire her, move on to the new equipment, move on to the moon, on to Mars. This is the handwriting on the wall because, remember, there's six people's lives at stake every time they go out and suit up and get in this thing. And you cannot trust that this system is going to work the way it's advertised until you check and recheck and check again.
All right. Well, you just beat most of the networks by about a minute and a half, Richard. So thank you.
Thank you, George.
Appreciate you updating us in that situation. Back now with Richard Dolan, then your phone calls. Richard, Bill Burns is a co-author with me in my book, Worker in the Light, and I trust him. And he co-wrote the book The Day After Roswell with Colonel Philip Corso.
Right.
Bill Burns believes Corso's story. Mm-hmm. I don't know if Corso's story is real or not, but Bill Burns believes it, and I trust Bill Burns. So what's your take?
Well, I'm so glad you mentioned this, because ever since that Corso's book came out, which was, I think, in 1997, I've just been, like a lot of researchers, thinking he makes a lot of claims in there. They're not really verifiable. I will say this. I think that the critics of Corso often... I hate to criticize even people I like, such as Stan Friedman, but I think that they lack a certain level of objectivity when they go after Corso. And some of the other critics of Corso, in attacking him, calling him a fraud, I think are way over the top. I don't see this with Corso. The other thing I can tell you is that just various sources that I have who talk to me about this tell me that they know absolutely for sure that Corso was fundamentally telling the truth. That doesn't, what does that matter? But my feeling is that, there's a lot of mistakes in Corso's book. He was in his 80s when he wrote it. This is The Day After Roswell. For anyone who's not familiar, the base bare bones is that he said he was part of a very select basically team in 1960-61 to pass off acquired alien technology to American corporations for research and development and to kind of pass off the technology. He also said that at Fort Riley, Kansas in 1947, he happened to see an alien body that was in transport on the way, I think, to Wright-Patterson. So that's a pretty big thing to say. The thing about Corso, though, is that this is a guy who has real life credentials. And a number of people said, no, those credentials don't check out. I don't think that's true. I think his credentials do check out. And the more that I look into Corso, because I was at a point even 5 years ago where I thought, well, I'm not going to really take this very seriously. I now believe that Corso's story is probably fundamentally correct and probably fundamentally true. I do think that the book was rushed in to be released for the 50th anniversary of the Roswell event. In other words, in 1997, there was a huge rush to get this out because I think it would just help book sales. I'm sure it did, but that book needed some more editing. So really, it was rushed out, and I think it should have, in the best of all worlds, it should have gone through some more fact-checking, because there were a number of things that he mentioned, I can't even remember offhand, but they were like very easily identifiable factual errors. One person said to me that, in fact, when Corso was pointed out, when someone mentioned a Corso, like, did you really say that? Apparently his response was, what? I said that? I couldn't have said that. So I think a lot of the book was just sloppy, but that's a different thing from saying that it was fraudulent. And I don't believe. I mean, Corso was a junior member. He was attached to the National Security Council under Eisenhower. People said, no, no, you weren't a member of the National Security Council. Friedman, for example, mentioned this, and other people do too.
Right.
But he wasn't a member of the NSC staff, but he was attached to it as a junior military officer. He wasn't lying about that. People said, no, you only ran the foreign technology desk for 90 days in the year 1961. In fact, he ran it for 2 years. But when you look at the military records, it isn't immediately clear it's true. But Corso did run foreign technology desk for 2 years. So when you look at some of these things more closely, I think Corso does check out much more than people realize. So I happen to think, yeah, I mean...
So what percent would you say would be accurate? I mean, if he were to fabricate part of it, he'd fabricate most of it.
Well, right. I don't think he fabricated any of it. I don't think any of it is intentional fabrication.
Okay.
That's my feeling. I don't think that he would do that. That doesn't seem like Corso's history. I mean, he had a history even prior to this as a whistleblower and as an accurate one. He wasn't just some guy who came out of nowhere. So my sense is, The real issue isn't did he pass off technology to industry. To me, that's not that controversial and not that difficult to fathom. The real question that I have is, did he see an alien body in 1947? That's a hard thing to just misremember. I can't, you know, I'm thinking, if I were a 20-something-year-old soldier and I open up a crate and I'm looking at an alien body, I'm not soon to forget that.
No, far from.
And I'm not soon to make a mistake. I mean, if it's an alien, I think I can identify it, and I assume Corso did. So that's the real issue, and he says he did it. Honestly, George, my heart of hearts, I think he's telling the truth.
Yeah, I do too. As incredible as the story is.
Now, yeah, the problem is, like, when certain people latch onto it as like, this is the proof. I mean, I can't consider Corso anything like proof. I spoke at the Toronto conference a year ago with former Minister of Defense of Canada, Paul Hellyer. Hellyer got a lot of press because this is a guy who ran Canada's military for a couple of years, 4 years in the 60s, and he's talking about UFOs. That was great. One thing Hellyer said at that conference was that one of the things that turned him around was Corso's book. I happened to be sitting next to Stanton Friedman during that whole speech, and Stanton was just groaning the whole time. He was just miserable, and he's thinking, oh, why is Hellyer bringing up Corso? But I think he's more legitimate than people tend to give him credit for being, although in a public venue, I consider Corso damaged goods, and just because there's been so much controversy about him. So I don't think you'd be wise to use him as your first line of argument.
Yeah, I think Bill's got some further notes that Corso took. So, you know, there may be a part two coming up here.
Yes, I think that there is a further story. And indeed, the family of Philip Corso Jr. has spoken publicly a number of times. And so, yeah, there's more to say on this. But, you know, the real issue is, I mean, my God, George, we're so lucky we got a guy like you doing the radio, because there aren't that many other venues for people like us to talk about these things. Where is the mainstream media here to give these stories the kind of scope that they truly deserve?
True, and let's give Art Bell the credit for being the pioneer in all this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, without him, you know, pushing this when people, you know, thought he was crazy, you know, and nuts, this never would have happened.
He deserves a tremendous amount of credit for that. I totally agree.
Let's go to the phones. They've been waiting for you, Richard.
Wow.
East of the Rockies, you're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Hi, my name is Deborah. Hi, Richard. Hi, George.
Hi.
Hi, Deborah.
I have more of a comment than anything else, and that would be, to me, the government is going to do what they're going to do. There's proof every day that there are things that we just definitely don't know about. Now, I'm an abductee. It happened to me in 73, and what I believe, and I'm wondering what the audience would think about this, is the average person, it seems like their frequency and their concepts are stuck. They're stuck in the mud, for lack of better words. And myself, being a human being who was abducted, it took me about 10 years or more, and then all of a sudden I realized that my frequency level as a person, being psychic and being an artist, everything seemed to be bumped up. And
but Deborah, you think that the experience you had actually triggered something in you to bring to another level?
Yes, I do, and I'm grateful for it.
Wow.
That's what I think. And as far, like I said, as far as the government goes, we know they hide things every single day. CBS is not going to go on TV and say, oh, yes, there are aliens, and yes, it takes all these books because the average person needs proof. I don't need proof. It happened.
Well, listen, I think I take your point very well. I would quibble with one thing, which is that there's a strong tendency for people to say, well, it doesn't really matter what the government does. We don't need the government to know what's true. And I agree with that. We don't need the government to validate what we know to be true. However, last time I checked, we were supposed to be living in a Republican, democratic system of government in which power devolved to the people. So that, in other words, so that the government is supposed to be responsive to us, all right? And if we as a society have this major phenomenon that we are interacting with every day, and we can't get a responsible government response to this, then we've got a real problem, all right? This is a phenomenon that involves massively powerful technology by entities unknown for purposes unknown that most people, by the way, are dealing with totally atomized, cut off from other people. Okay? So where's our coordinated response? Well, it's supposed to be from our government. Now, maybe our government is responding in a way and, you know, they're keeping it secret. But you know what? Look, we're not 5 years old. This is my point. I think we're grown up enough, and we're in a situation where I think the events in the world around us may force us to be a little more upfront about this. I mean, I don't think we should just be sitting on our duffs all day waiting for Big Brother to tell us when they're going to let us know. I'm not sure I feel very comfortable with that.
Okay, let's pick up next. Let's go to our West of the Rockies line. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hello.
Yeah, go ahead, please.
Yes, I have a question. And, okay, it started like when I was really little. Me and my sister, probably like when we were like in grade school, maybe second, third grade.
Yes.
Okay. Me and my sister would play in the backyard, and something got a hold. I saw this, like, it was like a disc like thing. And then I saw my sister levitate, and she disappeared, right? Well, when I turned around, you know, my sister here, she comes out of the bushes, and my sister was abducted, and I believe I was abducted as well because that happened. And then I was with a friend. I was coming home, and there was the moon. It was like it turned to like it was like two moons in one. Well, it took a snapshot, like a picture when you take a picture, you know, the flash. It went to a flash, and then, like, as my eyes was adjusting, it turned bright red. You know what I'm saying?
And how, were you much older at this point? You weren't a child.
This was like way after when I was a little kid, when that one experience happened.
Right, the first one. But the second one?
Second one was like 3 years ago.
Okay,
I'm 34.
Okay.
Okay, and then me and my sister, we'd be outside, and we've witnessed a lot of things, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I like to know also, we see ships, okay, and we have seen aliens, but they look like spiders.
What do you mean they look like spiders?
Well, like, I don't know. It was like a crazy form.
You could see them in the ship windows or something?
Did you see these in bed when you were sleeping?
No, we'd be outside in the dark. Because me and her, we go outside and we explore to see ships. You know, because we go outside and I mean, the different kinds of UFOs and spaceships that we see is like phenomenal.
Well, if I were you, I'd be living with a camcorder attached to my hip at all times.
All times. I want to know about these spider beans.
The spider beans? I don't know. It's crazy. It's really hard to describe. And I've a lot of things. And
how many legs do they have? Eight legs? Six legs?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. And it might sound crazy, but like,
yeah,
like it was like different. You know, like different types of forms. Like they were formed crazy.
They shape shifted on you?
Something like that. Yeah, it's hard to explain. And
have you talked to many, like, family about this? What do they think about it?
No, me and my sister, pretty much, they're pretty close-minded.
The family is?
Yeah, because when my sister was abducted and she came back, you know, because, like, I couldn't even, like, if there was a wall blocking her, you know, it was like she was hypnotized to this. But it was crazy because when she came back down, her two pinkies were like if there was skin grown underneath it, and her pinkies like if they were broken. You know what I'm saying? We went in, and I remember we telling our mother this, and my mother tried to sit there and say, no, you were born like that. And when I know well she was not born like that, and I looked at my mom.
Well, wouldn't your mother know?
You know what? I told my mother that Rosemary's fingers has always been, and I tried to recorrect her, and I got into really big trouble, you know, because my mom didn't believe. They're very close-minded.
Well, I don't know. Richard, we're coming up to the break here.
Yeah,
but,
the thing is,
I don't know what you could recommend for her.
It's a story that's so out there. Look, I've heard a lot of crazy stories. I don't think yours is crazy necessarily, but it's so far out that you have to do the best you can to verify it.
So if you're able to
have a camcorder, do things like this, you got to record it. If you've seen multiple UFOs, a lot of people who have seen multiple UFOs, you find out that they often discover that they may have been abducted.
This could have been the praying mantis figures, too, that she's seen. I mean, they look like spiny.
I no longer dismiss really outlandish stories immediately. I've learned to realize that.
All right, stay with us. Richard Dolan, our guest. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. On our next Coast to Coast program, the End Times Prophecy, so get ready for that. Lots of things have been going on. Are we in end times? We'll get another perspective. That'll be on our next Coast to Coast show. Richard, before we go back to final calls, tell us how people can learn more about you and your work.
Sure. Thank you, George. I have a website. It is keyholepublishing.com, just like looking through a keyhole, keyholepublishing.com. And that's got it's got about 40 pages of my first book up online. You can just read the whole introduction, some various chapter segments, a bunch of articles that I've written, updates on what I'm doing these days. And so it's probably the best good place to start.
By the way, anybody listening to us on our number one station in Seattle, KVI, which I'll, of course, be out there for a book signing sometime in October, they're getting double audio. So engineer there, get there and fix it quickly. I'm getting hundreds of emails from people saying, help us.
Hey, I'm getting emails during our interview here, George, from some like really interesting people.
Oh, of course.
One person is telling me, who's working down at Cape Canaveral in the 60s during the Apollo missions, talking about ET UFO sightings down at Cape Canaveral during that. I need to correspond with this person a little bit more to get some details, but he seems very on the level. Another person who talks about how her husband, and she knew an Air Force colonel at Edwards Air Force Base, who offhandedly at a social event, this is your thing about you can't keep leaks secrets.
That's right.
There are alien bodies in a freezer over at Edwards, and said that our military had developed antimatter weapons. This is in the mid-1980s. She said, "I've never forgotten it.
I love it."
So you know, I mean, there's evidence going back through the 1980s that we've had some really exotic technology that we have developed. There's an aerospace journalist, James Goodall, who developed some contacts at that time, and one of his Area 51 contact said to him, this is almost a famous quote in the field now, he said, we have technology that would make George Lucas envious. We have stuff in the Nevada desert, he said, that would make George Lucas envious. Back mid-1980s.
Back to the phones. First time caller line, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi, this is Steve calling from Los Angeles, George.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for calling.
Oh, I'm so glad to be on. I just want to tell you real quickly, I just started listening here. My friend's listened for years. I started listening in July. And I haven't missed a show since.
Well, great. Thank you.
And what I've got to tell everyone right now is it's just what everyone needs to hear. Everyone's talking about proof of UFOs, and I keep hearing this proof. So I'm a scientific person. I studied astronomy at UCLA in 1961, and I followed the space program closely. And listen to this. James McDivitt is on a show one night. I can't tell you what the show is, but he's on his mission. He's looking out the window, and he sees a cylindrical object with an appendage coming out the side.
Right.
And and he takes it with two Hasselblad cameras, the picture. And when he gets back to Houston, this is when they're based in Houston, he goes in to find out about the picture and say, oh, we don't have any pictures like that. So, you know, that was that on that show. And then this is months later, and you're going to have to look into what TV station it was. I think it was Channel 11, and I'm not sure of the year, but you see about the time frame I'm talking about. And NASA, this is a NASA-produced program. At the top of the show, they say some people may not be ready for what they're about to see, and they just want to warn everybody. And here's what I want to tell, and here's what it's gone lost somehow. NASA showed and admitted that every single flight to the moon, every flight to the moon, there and back, was accompanied by a physical or nebulous object. And then here's the one by one, and here they start to say James McDivitt, and you know, my eyes get real big. And there it is, just like you said, a cylindrical object like a can with an appendage coming out the side.
Fascinating. And, of course, we all are aware of Buzz Aldrin's recent statement that he said, you know, on the Apollo 11 mission, on the way out there,
right.
we were followed by an object we could not identify.
Right. But NASA seems to be, or no one seems to know about this show. They showed them all. I made notes on the show.
You know, I don't know about it.
Yeah. This
I don't know about it.
And I got some other astounding facts here. But that show needs to be dug up. And you know, that needs to be brought to some of these seminars coming up here.
I'm taking notes as you speak. I'm going to try to hunt that down. I'll try to talk to some
people,
see what I can find.
You know, if I come across my notes.
What period of time did it show, did you say? The 70s, 80s?
I'm not sure when James McDivitt's flight was, but
well, that was in the 60s. Yeah.
Okay. So this show is in the late 70s or early 80s.
Okay.
Here's something that's just going to blow everyone's mind. You know, I'm a scientific student. Like I said, I got Scientific American, and the January Scientific American in the category Science and the Citizen. There's an article in there. I've got a copy of it. It's called "Kicking the Gong." The first, now this is January 1970, so this is covering the flight, you know, first landing on the moon. And when they blasted back off the moon, you know, with the LEM and docked with the command module, they jettisoned the rocket and the LEM back to the moon to calibrate the seismometer they left there. And here's what happened. The article's called Kicking the Gong. The moon reverberated and resonated for 56 minutes. It increased in resonance for like 9 minutes and took another 50-something minutes to stop ringing.
Yeah.
That's in Scientific American.
Heard about that. Some people say that means the moon is hollow. What is... George, do you know about this idea of the hollow moon theory, the moon ringing like a bell?
Yeah, there have been some people who have theorized that the moon is artificial.
Right.
And that, of course, what we see are, you know, millions and millions of years of just, you know, caked up problems, getting hit by meteors and asteroids that make the crater look on the moon.
Because I've heard, too, that the moon rings like a bell.
But it may, but I don't think it's artificial. I think the moon broke off from good old planet Earth.
Yeah,
also might have been part of whatever object collided with
that
us.
That seems certainly much more realistic.
That's the thing. There's a lot of great mysteries in this universe.
Yeah, it really is.
But let's not get too far-fetched here. And I don't think the moon is artificial.
Right.
Or towed in.
But the damn thing rings like a bell, though.
East of the Rockies, you're on Coast to Coast. Hi there. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah, go ahead, sir.
Oh, yeah. My name's Mike. I'm in Houston, Texas.
Yes, Mike.
I wanted to let you know that back in the late 60s, I was living in Lincoln, Nebraska, and I met this lady and was talking to her and found out her husband had transferred from Washington, D.C. So I asked her what she did in Washington. She said, oh, I worked at the Pentagon. I said, oh, really? I said, what'd you do? She said, I worked on Project Blue Book. And I said, oh, how cool.
I like that.
I said, what can you tell me? She said, well, she said, I can't tell you anything except this. What they have would scare the hell out of you. And she said, I can't go beyond that, so don't ask me.
Wow.
And that's really all I wanted to share with you tonight.
And those were her exact words, huh?
Yeah. What they have would scare the hell out of you, her exact words.
Mm-hmm. You know what's amazing is that the Blue Book records are pretty much public domain at this point. I mean, anyone can go in and read them. And the Blue Book reports are, you know, they're kind of interesting, but they're not that overly dramatic. A few of them are. So a lot of people have really speculated that there are secret Blue Book files. I really wonder if that's what she's referring to.
Well, maybe so. What would they mean, though, scare the hell out of you? What could be so scary?
Well, it would be kind of scary to someone who's gone their whole life not believing in aliens to think that there's, you know, a non-human intelligence kind of zipping around our skies. I mean, that's kind of scary. Or if you were to learn that they were, even in the mid-60s, abducting people or doing tests or...
And we couldn't stop it.
Or if they lived here underground permanently. I mean, all of those things are pretty scary. I mean, to lots of people. I guess I'm kind of used to it at this point in my life, but... I meet people all the time, even today. They find out that I'm a UFO writer. They start talking to me. And every now and then, I'll run into someone who gets really creeped out by it. And they just don't want to deal with it. So there's a lot of people out there who still have that kind of reaction.
Okay, next up, let's go to our West of the Rockies line. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi. George. Hi, this is Mary Michael. I'm sorry, I have a cold tonight.
Well,
you sound great, though.
Thank you.
That's all right.
I was just going to say, I was just listening to the last caller, and maybe what they're scared to death about is the rumor about fiction and how the aliens made us, which would throw God off.
Right, the rumor about what was the first part that you said?
Yeah, but somebody had to make them, Mary Michael.
Exactly. Now, I do believe in God, but that wasn't really what I was calling about. But, you know, that would be scary to a lot of my parents. You know, and I just believe that God made whatever. Mm-hmm. He was the beginning, and we were all with him. But what I called about was I saw a show on Larry King a couple of years ago with Jimmy Carter on, and he had said, you know, when he was running, he had said that he was going to disclose Blue Book and let the American people
right.
know. And he tried, and Big Bush, that's what I call, you know, Big Bush, President Bush, the first one, hadn't been in office yet, but he wasn't he in the CIA or something?
He'd been director of the CIA.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, no, not under Carter's administration.
No, but for
no.
the prior year under Gerald Ford.
Right.
Yeah.
And Carter went to him and said, I want all this information. And he said, even though Carter was president of the United States, talk about shadow governments, Bush wouldn't give it to him.
Right. That's I'm sure that's true. Did Carter
did he,
say
did
that
he,
on the Larry
he,
King
yeah,
show?
I was going to say, did
no,
he say that?
No, he did not say that on the Larry King show.
Well, where did it come from?
I heard that before, and I'd read about it.
Rumors. I never heard that.
Yeah, I heard this one. Yeah.
Richard, did you hear that he used that?
Well, he's my father's third cousin.
Specifically?
Too.
Well, yeah. What the rumor actually derives from conversations between Attorney Daniel Sheehan and a friend of his, Marcia Smith, who worked at the Library of Congress. And apparently this is what she told to him. She told him. She apparently knew this.
Hearsay, Richard. Hearsay. We want proof.
Well, look, I'm just telling you, man, where the story comes from. I think it probably happened. Carter did get briefed by Bush. We know that this happened prior to taking the office. They did meet. George Bush wrote about it in his memoirs and, in fact, described Carter's attitude, very hostile to CIA and so forth. Bush did take Carter and Walter Mondale, vice president-elect, aside for a specialized briefing, apart from all the other CIA people there. This was at Carter's home. So they did have a briefing, and there is reason to think that Carter did ask Bush about UFO information, and that Bush basically said no. Carter did campaign about and did deal with the UFO issue as a campaigning as a candidate,
but kind of clammed up after he got elected. For
he
that
did
time.
What he did. Carter, I got to give this man some credit. For the first year of his presidency, he genuinely tried, to some extent, he tried to kind of get NASA to take the UFO problem and to sort of become a new version of Blue Book. And NASA, with the CIA standing right behind them, said absolutely no way, and they just fought Carter tooth and nail,
well,
and they ended up winning.
The old embassy takeover was his undoing.
But Carter was interested, and as a candidate, did talk about UFOs. It was a unique thing. I mean, really, there aren't any other U.S. presidential candidates who talked about UFOs while they were running for office.
But didn't Bill Clinton, once he got elected, didn't he try to find out what was going on?
Clinton did. Clinton was interested in UFOs. So was Ronald Reagan, by the way. Ronald Reagan was almost obsessed by UFOs.
Well, I know Ronald Reagan's son, Michael, and he told me that his dad had seen one over the old ranch and wanted to get to the bottom of it, but apparently never did, or at least that's what Michael says.
Yeah, there are several Reagan UFO stories, as a matter of fact. So, but yeah, Clinton, I think, was interested. Jimmy Carter, though, certainly was. And as far as that meeting with Bush, it is hearsay, but I find it at least plausible.
Yeah, but I mean, here again...
But what's your problem with it, George? I mean, why is it so difficult to believe?
Well, it's not a matter of difficult to believe. It's just that there's no proof.
No, exactly.
That's my look. I'm a newsman, you know, and I will report on stories all day long. But, you know, it would be nice to get some hard evidence once in a while.
Yeah, and Marcia Smith, the source of the story, from what I'm hearing, she's really not talking to people. So.
And I think people want hard evidence now. I think they're waiting for it. I think they're anxious for it.
Absolutely. We need to be striving for it at all times. I'm with you on that.
I mean, I get emails every day from people about things and past shows, and they say, what happened to this person? I don't know. We can't find him. What happened to this person? I don't know. We can't find him.
Talk is cheap.
People want hard evidence nowadays.
Yeah. This is what we need to do. This is my whole purpose in this field is to try to lay out as clearly as I can a factual basis for this. And
true.
You know, it's tricky because when you get into it long enough, you start encountering stories, and they're not all confirmable, and you have to really decide, what do I do with it? I'm continuing to try to be as careful as I can be and to document everything as carefully as I can and just do my best.
Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Richard Dolan on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, my name's Danny. I'm from Denver.
Hi.
On the subject thing.
Hey, do me a favor. You sound like you're in the bottom of an ocean. Are you muffling yourself on purpose or what? I can't hear you.
Yeah, it's hard to hear you.
No, is this better?
Yes, much better.
Yeah.
Okay. On the subject of a lack of proof, how credible would you say Walter Haut is in his description of what happened to Roswell?
Well, you know, you may not know, there's been a controversy just lately in the last year regarding Walter Hout. Walter Hout was the public information officer.
And he just passed away, right?
Yes, he recently died.
Yeah.
His daughter runs the Roswell Museum in Roswell, New Mexico. And there is a controversy. I don't know all the details about this, in fact, because they're not all available, relating to what Walter Hout said privately on videotape and what he has supposedly in a sealed letter. And this letter has not been revealed publicly. And he has some kind of major statement, and I just spoke with his daughter not just a couple of months ago, and she's not letting anyone see what's in this letter. This is like some major revelation that he has.
Now, a positive or negative? What do you think?
The impression I got is that it's a positive thing in the sense like that he's apparently confirming that he's been telling the truth about.
God, why won't she let that loose then?
I don't know. There are family issues. Apparently, there's personal stuff involved, and it's not anything that I have any control over, but I did meet with her. She's a really wonderful person, and I hope that she's able to release some more information on this. And, there's a video apparently that's in control of another UFO researcher has control of, and whether this is going to be released, I've got no idea. Is he credible? Yeah, he said. Hoth's main thing, of course, is that he's the man who issued the press release on flying saucers. And to me, that's really the sum total of his importance. I mean, additional claims have to wait until I see evidence for this.
Right. And the military went back to him and had him yank it, right, and change the story.
Right. That's right. That's exactly it. And if in this letter or in this video he has other revelations that we can follow up on, great. Let's see what he has to say.
When does the extended portion of the book come out, taking us to 2006?
It's my next book, really. I expect to have it out. I kept saying end of 06, end of 06. I'm thinking early 07. I'm working on it. It's coming along. I'm actually very happy with the writing. It's a longer book than I had originally planned. I was hoping to keep it to 500 pages, but it won't be less than 600.
And how about conferences for you, Richard?
I'll be speaking. It's possible that I'll be in the United Kingdom in a few weeks if they can nail this thing down for a conference in Bristol. But I'll definitely be at the Crash Retrieval Conference in Las Vegas in early November. And after that, I don't really have too much lined up. I've actually been very low-key all year, George. I have not solicited or gone to too many conferences. My wife has attended more than I have.
Time to exploit yourself again, Richard.
Well, after the book's out, I imagine that I'll be out there.
Okay, my friend. Thanks for spending the 3 hours with us.
I had a great time talking with you and with the guests and just going into all the stuff that we've done. It's been great.
All right. Richard Dolan for Steve Carr, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesure, Ross Mitchell, Ian Punnett, and of course Art Bell. I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM, we'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.